Brothers and sisters, now 9 o'clock. We are ready to begin our first class. Our speaker is Brother Gary Cousins. The theme for Brother Cousins' classes this week is Nehemiah, Spiritual Leadership in Challenging Times. Today's class is entitled Ecclesial Structure, Who Does What, Commitment and Engagement. Brother Gary.
Well, good morning, brethren and sisters. Wow, that's really good. Wow, I think this morning was the best one. So is it okay to diss on one of the fellow speakers when they're not present? Is that okay? Some are saying no, some are saying, I'm going to do it anyway. And Brother Jim is not here, but is Margaret here? Is she here? So I'm sure this message will get back to him. I'm relying on you to get it all back to him. But how do you recognize an Australian in a rainstorm? I was looking out the front window, and Amy and I were sitting in our living room. We're looking out the front window, and there he is in the rain trying to take pictures of the lightning. and then he's leaving his apartment next door. And somebody needs to draw a diagram of how to work an umbrella. An umbrella doesn't go like this, it goes like this, right? Umbrellas don't work too well when they're convex, but he popped his umbrella up and his umbrella went all the way up and it took him about 30 seconds to get it back down again. So obviously in Australia, they don't really use umbrellas that much, and he had some great difficulty with it. So when you see Brother Jim, ask him whether umbrellas go concave or convex. It was pretty funny. Anyways, structured for success, Nehemiah chapter 11 this morning. You know, the wall had been rebuilt. There was, we said yesterday, there was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of energy. There was a feeling of accomplishment amongst the people. And yesterday we talked about them sealing the covenant, and the people were now gathered as one, and they were headed in the right direction, right? But there's a danger in that, isn't there? The danger is that as the excitement of the events of the seventh month subsided, that they would slip back to the way they were before. As spiritual enthusiasm waned, involvement would drop off, engagement would subside, and the demographic of the ecclesia would change and migrate back to the old normal, if you will, the way it used to be. And that's just the pattern of human nature, isn't it? We'd like to begin this morning in Revelation chapter 3, and we're only going to be there for just a moment. But Revelation chapter 3 talks about the demographics of an ecclesia that was an ecclesia of the living dead, if you will. Revelation chapter 3 talks about the ecclesia in Sardis. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on the ecclesia in Sardis, other than to point out that there were three types of brethren and sisters in this ecclesia. At the end of verse 1, there were those who were dead. In the middle of verse 2, the second type, there were those who were ready to die. And then at the end of verse 4, there were those, a few of them in the ecclesia, who were worthy. And so, when we look at those, the word ready to die, if you look at the Greek, they were expected to die off is what the Greek word actually means there in Revelation chapter 3. But in an apathetic ecclesia, this would be the type of demographics that exist. And the large portion of the ecclesia would be in category 1 or category 2. And that's where the children of Israel were before Nehemiah arrived back in Jerusalem. And those who were left in Jerusalem, the worthy like Hanani, were very few, and they were the ones that traveled to Babylon to bring Nehemiah back. And Nehemiah was trying to prevent this demographic in the ecclesia from, or prevent them from going back to that demographic in the ecclesia. Nehemiah's challenge was to prevent them falling away and to maintain the momentum. And often the people in these two categories, are there not because they've lost the truth, not because they've chosen to walk away. A lot of times it's just that they don't feel engaged, that they don't feel involved, that they don't feel like they're contributing to the ecclesia, and so they naturally migrate to the sidelines. And Nehemiah understood that. And Nehemiah's challenge now was to set up a structure and establish new spiritual patterns and habits in the ecclesia to prevent them migrating back to that demographic in the ecclesia. His challenge now was to design a framework with checks and balances in it that would facilitate and maintain the spiritual well-being of the ecclesia without Nehemiah having to be present. And that was the key. It needed to be self-sustaining. And so here's the journey that Nehemiah has taken us on so far. Right? Here's Israel's pattern on the left-hand side. Sin, sorrow, defeat, and captivity. Time and time again, that's the pattern of the children of Israel, right? They sin, they sorrow, they're defeated, they're taken captive, they start over again, they sin, sorrow, defeat, captive, right? That's the pattern that Nehemiah is trying to break. And so how does he go about it? In chapter 8, you know, they get back to the reading of the word. There's a prayer. We didn't look at the prayer in chapter 9, but we did look at Nehemiah as a man of prayer. And he establishes the sealing of the covenant, their commitment, in chapter 10. And now in chapter 11 and 12, he tries to put together an organization and a structure to the people to maintain the momentum that he has been able to accomplish to this point. And this particular area down here, organization engagement, chapters 11 and 12, that's what we want to talk about this morning. So let's go back to Nehemiah and the city of Jerusalem. So Nehemiah is starting with an empty box. Go back to Nehemiah chapter 7 and verse 4. Nehemiah chapter 7 and verse 4 talks about the state of the city of Jerusalem. It says, "Now the city was large and great, but the people were few and the houses were not builded." So he's starting with this empty box. The city was large, it was great, but there was hardly anybody there, right? And the houses had not been built. There was no infrastructure, there was no commerce, there was no legislature, there was no worship in the temple. The city had not established any defense systems. There was no inhabitants, and it had, you know, you have to remember, and we said this on day one, that it had been uninhabited, virtually uninhabited, for 140 years. So you can imagine, you know, all the rubble, and it's all grown over, and there's thorns and thistles and all of that in the city. It's not necessarily a place that you really want to move to. So Nehemiah has his challenge, and he takes a strategic approach. And here's Nehemiah's approach in Nehemiah chapter 11. The first step he takes is to establish servant leadership in Jerusalem. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. He then goes about to repopulate the city. If he doesn't repopulate the city, if they don't set up some kind of structure and some kind of defense systems, the city and those around the city, the heathen around about, are just going to invade and the walls are going to be broken down again. And so it's, you know, critical, and it's time sensitive, that they need to establish this and do it rather quickly. He's then going to take inventory of the resources that are available to him and examine past practice, and he does that in Nehemiah chapter 7 and chapter 11. And then based on the resources available, and he uses some of the models and ideas from past practice, and we've seen him do that already, right, from Josiah. And then he's going to reorganize and re-engineer the division of duties amongst the people. And so that's his approach here in Nehemiah chapter 11. So let's talk about servant leadership. And servant leadership is the type of leadership that we need in our ecclesias. Those who are spiritual leaders need to be servant leaders. And a servant leader, put very simply, is a servant first and a leader second. A servant leader is somebody who leads by example. A servant leader is somebody who is not comfortable asking others to do what they themselves are not willing to do. A servant leader makes sure that the people's highest priorities and their highest needs are being met. A servant leader is focused primarily on the growth and the well-being of the people in which they serve, and their greatest interest and their greatest satisfaction is when those people perform at the highest level of their potential. A servant leader is somebody who does not keep authority and power to themselves. A servant leader is somebody who distributes authority and power. They empower others in the ecclesia, and then they support them by removing obstacles and by removing roadblocks so that they can make the decisions and they can make things happen in the ecclesia. That's a servant leader. Turn, if you will, to Luke chapter 22. In Luke chapter 22, he talks about there what servant leadership is. And here's the scriptural definition of a servant leader in Luke chapter 22. We're going to read there at verse 25. Excuse me. And he said unto them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. They're autocrats, they're dictators, right? And they exercise authority upon them and are called benefactors, because who benefits the most from that type of leadership? The dictator. But ye shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief, as he that doth serve. Scriptural definition of servant leadership. And so who does Nehemiah choose to be the servant leader? We come to Nehemiah chapter 7 in verse 2, if you're still there. Nehemiah says, I gave my brother Hanani and Hananiah, the ruler of the palace, charge over Jerusalem. And why? Because he was a faithful man and he feared God above many. So there was a qualification, and Hanani and Hananiah met that qualification. And so he appoints them as being in charge over Jerusalem. And we label them as servant leaders because if we come over to Nehemiah chapter 11, where we're going to spend most of the rest of our time this morning, the very first sentence of Nehemiah chapter 11, verse 1, it says, and the rulers of the people dwelt at Jerusalem. So they hadn't chosen people to populate the city yet, but Nehemiah gets Hanani and Hananiah and those who were to rule over the people that we're going to look at in just a moment, and he says, you group of leaders, you need to be the first ones that move into Jerusalem. You cannot ask the people to do something that you yourselves are not willing to do. You will live in Jerusalem. And you will move there now. And that's where you will be. That's servant leadership, right? And Nehemiah coached them to lead by example. And here's what's the mentality of Nehemiah. Now turn to Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12 has a future context. I understand that. But the Zechariah chapter 12 captures the thinking of a servant leader that will exist in the kingdom. Zechariah chapter 12. I'm having trouble finding Zechariah. Where is it? There it is. Zechariah chapter 12. It's just before Malachi, right at the end of the Old Testament, if you're having trouble with me. Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 5. We know this is future, right? Verse 3, and in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the people, all that burden themselves, so on and so forth. We come down to verse 5. And the governors of Judah shall say in their hearts, and here's the mindset of the servant leader, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength in the Lord of hosts, their God. Right? The strength of the leader is not in and of themselves. It's not a dictatorship. It's not an autocratic society, right? The strength of the leader is in the people. It's very different, isn't it, than some of the leadership that we see around us today. The strength of the ecclesia is in the people. The strength of the ecclesia is not dependent upon the strength of the recording brother or the arranging board or the Sunday school superintendent. The ecclesia is as strong as its weakest member. The ecclesia is as strong as the member that is the least engaged. The ecclesia is as strong as the members that are the least involved. And that's why if we are spiritual leaders in the ecclesia, we need to make sure that we're looking at the demographics of our ecclesia, the talents and abilities of those in the ecclesia, and we need to invite everyone in the ecclesia to be part of the operation of the ecclesia, not just a few. And we need to work with the ecclesia and get them to maximize their involvement based on the talents that they've been given. That's servant leadership. And in the ecclesia, the glory, when the ecclesia thrives, is not to the leader. The glory is to God. And so once he sets up servant leadership, the next job is to repopulate Jerusalem. And it's interesting how he chooses to do that, isn't it? Verse 1 of Nehemiah chapter 11, picking up where we left off. The rest of the people also cast lots to bring 1 of 10 to dwell in Jerusalem, the holy city, and 9 parts to dwell in other cities. And the people blessed all the men that willingly offered themselves to dwell at Jerusalem. And so 1/10 of the population was chosen by lot to move to Jerusalem. And it says in verse 2, the people blessed all the men that willingly offered themselves to dwell at Jerusalem. So it's unclear how this was actually done. There's probably 1 of 2 ways that this was done. It could have been that Nehemiah asked for volunteers. And they're the ones that are being referred to in verse 2, that the people blessed that willingly offered themselves to dwell at Jerusalem. And they didn't get enough to move into Jerusalem, and so then they had to go by lot. That's one possibility. But I'd like to suggest to you, the second possibility is this, and I'm going to suggest that this is more probable. Apparently, when a man was chosen by lot, he was permitted to decline if he wanted to. A man could be chosen, but could decide against moving. The lot would be cast again, and another chosen, until someone was found willing to consent. And those are the ones that are the ones that consented to the lot are the ones that are praised of the people in verse 2. But in either one of those scenarios, it's clear that volunteerism did not work in the ecclesia. Volunteerism did not work in the ecclesia. There would have been a reluctance to accept the work and the public duty of citizenship in Jerusalem, wouldn't there? There would have been a reluctance to leave the family plot and then to go and move and upheave everything and move in and dwell in Jerusalem, that they would have had to start from scratch and rebuild. Asking for volunteers, I would suggest, doesn't necessarily work well in the ecclesia either. I would say it's marginally effective. And when I say that, I don't want to take away from all of those who willingly volunteer. That's awesome. And that brings glory to God. I don't want to take away from that at all. But in every ecclesia that I've been in, you know, there's a need and there's an announcement from the platform. We're looking for volunteers for whatever. And often you don't get the people, and you have to ask three or four times, and you still don't get the people. And if you do get the people, often they're not the right people for the task. And the reason why you don't get the people when you volunteer is because there's a thing called volunteer apathy. I don't know how many of you have been trained in first aid, but in first aid, what do they teach you about? They teach you about bystander apathy, don't they? And Ben and Alicia are well aware of this. A week ago today, they were at a baseball game and a fellow collapsed, and Alicia being a nurse, and Ben had a big knife in his pocket, and they ran up to the fellow, and Alicia started doing compressions on him, and Ben cut open his shirt, and Ben sent a guy out to call 911 and get the AED, and they put the AED on him. They shocked him, and he came back too, and the paramedics took him off, and he's doing well today, isn't he? Yes, you got an email yesterday saying that, right? But they had about 70 people standing around just watching. That's bystander apathy, right? And what do they teach you as a first aider to overcome bystander apathy? The way you overcome it is if you're the first responder, you start telling people what to do, right? You go and flag down the ambulance. You four people, you make a chain and you direct the ambulance to this spot. You go call 911. You go get AED. Is there anybody here who knows first aid? Please step up. We're going to have to, you know, spell off the people doing CPR. And you start telling people what to do. That's how you overcome bystander apathy, and that's how you overcome volunteer apathy in the ecclesia, because psychologically it's just our human nature that we won't naturally volunteer when there's a whole group of people because we think, oh, I'm not qualified, or oh, somebody else is going to do it. Oh, there's lots of people to do that. In the ecclesia, volunteerism will not accomplish the need for engagement. You know, if we just let people volunteer, right? Here's, you know, people's attitudes in the ecclesia and how they conduct themselves in the ecclesia. The ideal attitude is you want people to be, I'm going to say, mildly assertive, right? You want people to have some backbone in the ecclesia to speak up, to identify issues, to talk about them. You want them to be assertive, not aggressive, right? You don't want people to be passive. You want them to be, I'll say, comfortably assertive, in the middle of this continuum, if you will, right? If we ask for volunteers, who are going to be the first ones to volunteer? The first ones to volunteer are going to be the people at this end, right? The people that want the control, the people that want to have the influence, the people that want to be looked up to in the ecclesia. They're the ones that are first going to volunteer. Oh, you know, pick me, I'll do that, right? And the last ones that volunteer are going to be these ones down here who are sitting on the sidelines of the ecclesia. Ah, you know what? Someone else will do that. And so, you know, the 80-20 rule, right? The 80-20 principle rule in any group of people, right, is alive and well in the ecclesia, right? In a lot of ecclesias, 20% of the people do 80% of the work. And asking for volunteers doesn't fix the 80-20 problem, does it? If we ask for volunteers, the 80% of the work is going to be done by the 20% of the people that are naturally inclined to this end of the spectrum down here. And that's not what we want in the ecclesia. We want to bring these people back to here, and we want to bring these people here back to this center part here. And that's why volunteerism doesn't necessarily work in the ecclesia. And there was some university studies done. The University of Texas, they published a study, and it says there in that, and there's the quotes there from it, the number one reason people volunteer is because they're asked. So they're really not volunteering, right? They're asked. When you ask everybody, this is what this study says, when you ask everybody, when you send out an email or an announcement from the platform, right, saying, we need help with X, you're essentially asking nobody. It says that right in the study. The University of Lethbridge says people are 4 times more likely to volunteer when they're approached or when they're asked as when they're not. And so how do we overcome volunteer apathy in the ecclesia then? The problem with volunteer apathy, as we said, is it doesn't fix the 80-20 rule. It actually supports it. It doesn't balance the workload in the ecclesia, does it? And it doesn't take advantage of all the talents that exist collectively in the ecclesia. And so the leadership of the ecclesia has an opportunity. They have a challenge. They need to start to approach. They need to start to appoint. They need to start to ask. They need to start to request. They need to start to tap people on the shoulder. They need to seek out those who would do a good job at whatever the job is that needs to be done. They need to start assigning people to tasks like Nehemiah did. Ideally, everyone in the ecclesia needs an area of responsibility. And by an area of responsibility, I don't mean, you know, we need the trim painted in the bathroom. Can anybody do that? That's not an area of responsibility. But what they need is, you group of 4 or 5 people, you're in charge of painting the whole ecclesia. You choose the colors, you look at where it's peeling off, where it needs to be fixed. On work days, you're the ones that are going to buy the paint, buy the brushes, coordinate the workers. We want you to make sure that this ecclesia is well represented in the community, is neat and tidy, and the colors are appropriate. And if they choose to paint the bathroom lime green, so be it. But let them do the job. And couple your feedback with recognition. That's the challenge that we have in the ecclesia, isn't it? So Nehemiah's challenge now, you know, and he chose to use a drawing a lot system, right? Because moving back into Jerusalem didn't require special talents, didn't really require special abilities to relocate into Jerusalem. And so they cast lots, right? And that was their method of choosing. That was their method of tapping on the shoulder, right? What method you use in the ecclesia is up to you. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But Nehemiah's challenge now was to reorganize and re-engineer the population of Jerusalem, so that the functioning of society, especially the worship of God, was dependent upon everyone. He needed to now change the mindset of the people to working in their own little silo and eking out their own existence to working interdependently, where everyone is reliant on everyone else in the ecclesia. And so Nehemiah, and I know this is kind of busy. It's kind of busy, but Nehemiah reorganizes and re-engineers the people, right? And he organizes them basically into 4 divisions. So there's the children of Judah over here, and there's no leader identified for the children of Judah. There's the children of Benjamin that are here, and they had Joel as their leader, it says in verse 9. And it makes sense that most of the population was from Judah and Benjamin, right? Because they were the two tribes that bordered on Jerusalem. And then there was a group of priests that were headed up by Seraiah, and there was a group of Levites who were headed up by Uzzi or Uzzi in verse 22. And so there were those four divisions of people, and then in addition to that, there was one person, Pethahiah, whose function was to be at the king's hand in all matters concerning the people. So there you see the divisions of all the people and who were leading the four divisions. And then underneath those four divisions, there were other sub-leaders, if you will. Adaiah was over the brethren that did the work of the house. The chief of the fathers were listed there. There's 242 of them. Zabdiel was over the mighty men of valor. Eliashib was keeper of the chambers. And so on and so forth as we go through all of the Levites. Right, so Nehemiah had a structure, a framework in which the ecclesia was to operate. And he had put that together based on what he learned from Nehemiah chapter 7 and those who returned under Zerubbabel. And he modifies it a little bit and adds some functions to the people that he felt were necessary in Nehemiah chapter 11. And his focus, obviously, in this chart is heavily weighted toward the priests and the Levites, because that's the area that they were most efficient. And if they were going to be successful, they were not going to be successful as a people unless the priests and the Levites were successful in leading the people spiritually. And how does the law describe the priests and the Levites? Let's go back to Numbers chapter 3. Numbers chapter 3, and there's a phrase, and if you're a Bible marker, pull out a color pencil. You want to highlight this so that when you're doing the readings, it jumps out at you. But in Numbers chapter 3, there's an expression that's used to talk about the function of largely the Levites, but also the priests in the service of the temple. Verse 7 of Numbers chapter 3 says, "And they shall keep his charge and the charge of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of the congregation to do the service of the tabernacle." You want to highlight the phrase "to do the service." Also in verse 8, "And they shall keep all the instruments of the tabernacle of the congregation and the charge of the children of Israel to do the service." There's the expression again, to do the service of the tabernacle. Now turn over to Numbers chapter 4. Numbers chapter 4, and we read there in verse 3. Begin at verse 2. "Take the sum of the sons of Kohath from among the sons of Levi after their families by the house of their fathers from 30 years old and upward, even until 50 years old, all that enter into the host to do the work." Now, if you look at the word host there in that verse, and I think it's up on the screen, yes. The word host there means a mass of persons regularly organized for war. What? That's what the Hebrew means. That's what the word host means. Well, that's kind of interesting since they're going to serve in the tabernacle. Now turn to verse 19 of that same chapter. Halfway through the verse, "Aaron and his sons shall go in and appoint them, everyone to his service." There's the expression again, everyone to his service. Verse 23, "From 30 years old and upward until 50 years old shalt thou number them, all that enter in," and there's the expression again, "to perform the service." Now, if you have an Oxford Bible with a margin, what does your margin reference say under "perform the service" in verse 24? To war the warfare. To war the warfare. Go down to verse 30 of Numbers chapter 4. From 30, this is with all of the families here. "For the sons of Merari," in verse 29, it says, partway through the verse, "everyone that entereth into the service." Now, if you have a margin there, what does it say for service in verse 30? It's in the margin. It's the word warfare. to do the work of the tabernacle of the congregation. Then there's the Kohathites in verse 35. Everyone that entered into the service, and the word service there is warfare. Everyone that entered into the warfare. And then the next family in verse 30. Everyone that entered into the service. Everyone that entered into the warfare. And then we come over to verse 47. From 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years old, everyone that came to do the service of the ministry and the service of the burden in the tabernacle of congregation. There's the expression again. Verse 49. Everyone according to his service in verse 49. Turn over to Numbers chapter 8. It's repeated time and time again, isn't it? Numbers chapter 8 and verse 11. Aaron shall offer the Levites before the Lord for an offering of the children of Israel, that they may execute the service of the Lord. Verse 15, after that shall the Levites go in to do the service of the tabernacle. Verse 19, I have given the Levites as a gift to Aaron and to his sons from among the children of Israel to do the service of the children of Israel in the tabernacle of congregation. Verse 22 of Numbers chapter 8, and after that went the Levites in to do their service in the tabernacle. Verse 24, this is that belongeth unto the Levites. From 25 years old and upward they shall go in to wait upon the service. Now again, in my margin, to wait upon the service, what do you have in your margin? To war the warfare, right? From 25 years old and upward they shall go in to war the warfare. And then look at how verse 25 continues. And from the age of 50 years, they shall cease waiting upon the service. What does your margin say for cease waiting on the service? The margin says, they shall return from the warfare of the service. Work in the ecclesia is not easy, is it? We perform a service, and we need to be disciplined in our service in the ecclesia. And they were to serve from 25 years old and upward until they were 50 years old. And then at 50 years old, they kick back and relax, right? Oh, yeah, I'm retired. No, doesn't happen. Look at verse 26. Says they shall cease from the service, right? They shall return from the warfare at the end of verse 25 and shall serve no more, but they shall minister with their brethren in the tabernacle of the congregation to keep the charge and shall do no service. The word charge there means oversight. They shall keep the oversight, but they themselves shall not do the service. Thus shalt thou do unto the Levites, touching their charge. And I'd like to suggest to you, there's three passages at the end of this slide, I'd like to suggest to you that Paul, in writing the epistles, alludes back to the service of the Levite and compares that to our service in the ecclesia. Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9, first of all at verse 1. Then verily the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service, right? We just read about all that. And a worldly sanctuary. Come down to verse 6. Now when these things were thus ordained, the priests went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service. The expression of God is not in the original. Accomplishing the service. That's what we've just read about, right? Warring the warfare. Then come down to verse 14. How much more then shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself up without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? See the transition? from the law, the service of the law, performing the service of the law, to now the service of God through Christ. Romans chapter 12, verse 1, we've read many times, I'm sure, but perhaps we've omitted the one word at the end of the verse or glossed over it. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And we're running out of time. We're not going to look up 2 Timothy chapter 2. But we need to look at ourselves as soldiers in the ecclesia. And we need to look at ourselves as soldiers that are on service. Doesn't matter how old we are. We are never on leave from the ecclesia. And so as we serve in the ecclesia, structure is important. And Nehemiah recognized the value of structure. He recognized the service that needed to be done. He needed to recognize that people needed to be organized like soldiers in the army. But he also recommended recognized the importance of structure. When structure is not provided, the management of affairs falls into the hands of the most opportunistic, self-seeking individual. That's human nature, right? Who will orchestrate affairs to suit their own personal advantage. To avoid this, it is essential that a public conscience should be aroused and that everyone should realize their duty to the greater good of the community. That's the purpose of the ecclesial guide. So what does the ecclesial guide say? This is what the ecclesial guide says about the structure of our ecclesia. In all communities, there must be order and mutual submission. Two things have to be secured in the conduct of an ecclesia. The one is order, and the other is individual liberty. Both are essential to the healthy and harmonious life of an ecclesia. The danger is that one or the other may be sacrificed in the endeavor to secure either. Both are to be secured by appropriate arrangements such as are indicated in this guide. Section 17 continues, "The appointment of brethren to certain offices is not the appointment of men to exercise authority, but of men to serve, servant leadership. One is your master, even Christ, and all ye your brethren. There must be no authority, only service." The ecclesia does not appoint masters, but servants. And then finally, ecclesial control, section 20. The right of the whole ecclesia to control proceedings should not be absolutely surrendered into the hands of those chosen. The ecclesia ought to retain a power of regulation and control. That's that public mindset, right, that we read in the previous slide. And I'm going to suggest to you that Robert Roberts, when he wrote the Ecclesial Guide, was modeling the things that he wrote for our current day ecclesias after how the first century ecclesias ran. So let's look very quickly at how the first century ecclesia operated. And in the first century ecclesia, it's apparent that there were, in the New Testament, three key functions in the ecclesia that provided or led the service in the ecclesia. They were bishops, they were deacons, and they were elders. And we're not going to go through all the qualifications. You have them listed there on the left, and they're all found in those two passages there. What a bishop is and what a bishop is not. Suffice it to say, though, that there will be certain positions in the ecclesia that have qualifications. And we need to make sure that those who we choose from in the ecclesia meet those qualifications. And then it doesn't matter, does it? If they all meet the qualifications, in theory, it doesn't matter whether we choose the lot system or we choose the democratic system, as long as they meet those requirements in the ecclesia. There were no requirements for people moving back into Jerusalem, right? Didn't matter. But in a position like this, the bishop of an ecclesia, there are requirements. And so if we're going to put somebody in that position, we need to first of all pick those who meet those requirements from which who will make the final decision. So in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 1, we're introduced to bishops and deacons. And we're not going to turn up Philippians 1 verse 1, but if you go to the Greek, the word means a superintendent, a watch, or an overseer. And go to Hebrews chapter 13. In Hebrews chapter 13, there's kind of one word, and it's the word guides, right, that describes their function in the ecclesia. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 7, it says, "Remember them which have the rule over you." Well, not necessarily a good translation in the English, right? Remember, there is no authority. We don't appoint people to authority in the ecclesia. We appoint servants, right? So what does your margin say? What does your margin say that for them that have the rule over you? For them that are the guides of the ecclesia. Remember them that have, that are the guides over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation. And again, over in verse 17, obey them that have the rule over you. Your margin again renders that as guides. Obey them that have the guide over you, and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. So they become the guides of the ecclesia. Remember that. Bishops, guides of the ecclesia. Deacons. Let's go to Acts chapter 6. Now, I don't necessarily want to turn to Acts chapter 6 because we're almost out of time. We only have about 2 minutes left. But in Acts chapter 6, we have the appointment of the seven, right, to take care of the ministration to the widows. Right? And in Acts chapter 7, that's the first appointment of a group of deacons in the ecclesia. When we look at deacons, the word means to run errands, to be an attendant, to be a waiter at the table. And what does Acts chapter 6 says? What does Acts chapter 6 say? We need to continue with the ministry. We shouldn't be waiting on tables. Right? That was the beginning of the deacons. And so they're ones who run errands, they're attendants, they're waiters at tables, those responsible to fulfill a specific need in the ecclesia. That's who the deacons are. And then there's the elders. They're the presbytery, the seniors in the ecclesia. You're not an elder just by age. Age is a criteria, but you're not an elder just by age. There was more than one elder in any given ecclesia. And sometimes elders served more than one ecclesia. They were shepherds and they were to attend to the chronically ill. Presumably, they were those who were deacons or bishops at one time. Those who, by reason of age and service, are able to provide spiritual wisdom and guidance, spiritual care and oversight of the ecclesia. They're appointed within the ecclesia and the ecclesial community. There's multiple in an ecclesia, and they can serve more than one ecclesia in a given location. And I'd like to suggest to you, of all of those three functions, this is the one that we've lost. How is an ecclesia supposed to operate? An ecclesia is supposed to be fluid. It's supposed to be dynamic. And we're going to conclude with this slide. The ecclesia starts down here, right? We monitor. This is kind of our radar system, if you will, in the ecclesia. We listen, we look at ecclesial demographics, personality differences that arise, behavior patterns, attendance, identifying the lost, the division of duties, the talents and skill set in the ecclesia. That all happens in this investigation box here. And then based on the issues that come out of here, we move up here to the interpretation. We define the problem. We look at scriptural examples, scriptural principles. And here's where we get the brainstorming over in here. This is the fish diagrams and the five whys, if you've done that in your occupation at work, and you develop a model and a potential solution, and then you start to test it and pilot it and implement it, and you approve and adjust it, and eventually you figure out what works and you concretize it, and then you start the process again. And the ecclesia is meant to be fluid. It's meant to be dynamic. When there's a need in the ecclesia, then the ecclesia has the ability to appoint a group, like in Acts chapter 6, to solve that issue. And I'm not trying to suggest that in an ecclesia we blow up arranging boards and blow up the ecclesial guide, but each ecclesia needs to structure themselves to meet their own individual needs and address their own individual issues. And in the first century, if you were to draw a line across here, this is how it worked. The elders and bishops work in the top half of this, and the deacons work in the bottom. And that's how an ecclesia is meant to operate. It's meant to be dynamic. It's meant to be fluid. And the elders and the bishops are constantly monitoring, guiding, and taking care and coming up with ideas, working with a group of deacons to solve a problem, and so on and so forth. And that's how the ecclesia is structured and meant to work and meant to function. And that's what Nehemiah was trying to set up in Nehemiah chapter 11. You might think, well, why is ecclesial structure important? It's because it prevents anarchy, both political and spiritual. It defines roles and responsibility and articulates the involvement of everyone. It prevents duplication of work. It identifies communication pathways and avenues to escalate issues in the ecclesia. It provides clarity and vision. Everyone can see and know how their function fits into the whole. And so what does it facilitate? An understanding of interdependence. I'm going to conclude with a parable. It goes like this. It's called The Carpenter's Tools. One evening, there was some discussion amongst the tools in the carpenter's shop. Brother Hammer, because he was too noisy, was asked by the other tools to leave the shop. But he said, "If I am to leave this carpenter's shop, Brother Drill must go too. He's always poking holes in others' work." Well, Brother Drill arose and said, "All right, but Brother Screw must also go. You have to turn him around time and time again in order for him to accomplish his job." Brother Screw responded, "If you wish, I will go. But Brother Plain must also leave. All his work is on the surface. There's no depth to anything that he does." Brother Plain replied, "Well, Brother Rule will have to withdraw also if I do, for he's always measuring folks as though he were the only one who is right." Brother Rule lodged a complaint about Brother Sandpaper, saying, "He's very coarse and abrasive. He's always rubbing people the wrong way." And in the midst of the discussion, the carpenter of Nazareth walked in to perform his day's work. He put on his apron and went to the bench and began the work of framing a building upon which his father was to place his name. He necessarily employed the screw, the drill, the hammer, the sandpaper, the saw, the plane, and all the other tools. After the day's work was over and the building was complete, Brother Saw eventually arose and wisely observed, "Brethren, I perceive that all of us are laborers together with God."